This is the sixth Appropriations Review Committee report. How does it differ from its predecessors?
It differs in two respects. One is that the previous two reports had recommended little or no funding increases. And so this report comes at the end of a period of either stagnant funding increases, no, or funding cuts. And this report felt that the reductions in funding for Parliament, it got to a stage that it was threatening the operation of our democratic systems. The second thing which this report differs from quite markedly is we proposed a change in the way in which the funding for Parliament was done. At the moment, it's done by the executive branch. That's Cabinet, who brings down a budget and recommends to Parliament how it's done. We were proposing that the funding for Parliament should be done by Parliament itself, because Parliament is to hold the executive to account on behalf of the people, and if the executive was able to restrict the funding of Parliament, it would therefore restrict the ability of parliamentarians to scrutinise the role of the executive. So we felt that the funding of Parliament should be done by Parliament itself, and we recommended that it be done by way of the of a committee of parliamentarians with expert advice.
Now, forgive me, I don't mean to be rude, but isn't this rather like giving pigs control of the trough?
No, it's not. It is a very open and transparent process, so that the officers of Parliament would have a select committee meeting, it would have open agendas, all of the reports would come to it, it would be open and available to the public. The recommendation of experts, such as the Appropriations Review Committee, which is I've been part of, would make a report to the Officers of Parliament. The Officers of Parliament would then make a recommendation to Parliament itself, and Parliament would debate it and would then decide whether it was fair and appropriate or not. Very similar to a budget process, only it wasn't a budget process for the executive. This is a budget process for Parliament. And we do this on a number of occasions. The Office of the Auditor General is an officer of Parliament. Their budget is determined by Parliament. The Ombudsman is an officer of Parliament, similar with that. And the Commissioner for the Environment is an officer of Parliament as well. So these are people who are answerable to Parliament, not to the executive branch, which is the Prime Minister and Ministers. I think it's a very important distinction, but people who look at politics from the outside simply see Parliament, Government, Cabinet, all as one thing, but it isn't.
Will this then make the Parliamentary Service open to scrutiny under the Official Information Act?
Not in itself, no, it wouldn't.
So the scrutiny would come at the Select Committee level?
Would come as, and it would be about the funding, not the how the actual individual be at the global figures for the funding, but it wouldn't be at the individual figures. And there are some reasons why the it should that having complete transparency of all of the funding in Parliament could be a problem. Members of Parliament operate in many ways, I would say, similar to that of a lawyer. They get representations from individual people. They travel to go and see them. This is between them and a particular person. So if MPs' air travel, telephone calls, all the rest of it was available for scrutiny, people could track the activities of the MP and see what they're doing. This would be of great interest to their political opponents, of course. But it also diminished the ability of individual members of the public and groups to have an interaction with the Member of Parliament. So I think there are some things which should be absolutely confidential. When I was a Member of Parliament, if someone walked through my door to see me, as far as I was concerned, what happened behind that closed door was absolutely privileged and absolutely confidential to them and them alone. Official Information Act requests were made for access to that information. I even had the Ombudsman come and see me for access to information, and I said a flat no. That is absolutely privileged, and it should remain that way.
Would the public get as much information about MP spending as they do now from this system? I mean, for instance, your taste for Mexican beer, would we find about that?
Well, that was actually as a when I was a minister, and some people came to see me when I was having dinner, and to be kind to them, I shouted some beers, as you do. I sat down, had a good yarn. And as restaurants too, they required it only to be a single payment by card. And as I'd had a meal, I paid with a card, and I reimbursed the cost of the beers, as I should have done at the time, the day I got back to the office. So in fact, Ministerial Service had the refund from me before they'd even got the bill from the restaurant. But it was on the foil, and people said, you know, I sort of blurred the rules somehow. But I thought I acted fairly. But yeah, of course, that's what happens when you're a minister. But when you're a member of parliament, you do not have a credit card to go and shout meals and pay your own costs. The current system, I think, in New Zealand works pretty well. You're entitled to a certain range of expenses when you go to a motel. You are not reimbursed meals. The meals are on you. And you get reimbursed on actual and reasonable. So if you want to go to a $300 a night room in Auckland, you're most welcome to. But you'll only get reimbursed to, it was at the time, $160 on the production receipt. Okay. So it's actual and reasonable. The system here in New Zealand does not compare at all with the problems that they had in England.
Yeah. $160, wasn't it?
Was, I think so.
Yes, but it's not bad for a couple of steaks and 16 Corona beers.
Oh, no, that wasn't... No, that's the cost of the room. No, I forgot what... It was a meal. I think it was about $40 for the meal. And it was 12 Corona beers. They had a big thirst. I don't actually drink Corona beer much myself, but they had a big thirst, and I just reimbursed. That's what happens when you remember Parliament. You shout people drinks as you meet them. That's what you're supposed to do.
Thank you for clearing that up. Just moving on to a more major expenditure, the report, I think, identifies a figure of $140 million a year for running Parliament.
Correct.
Which works out to what per person?
Approximately $30 per person, which I think is a pretty small figure, really. I think it's a pretty reasonable figure.
Did you make comparisons with other countries?
No, we didn't. We didn't have time to do that. But I would say that New Zealand Parliament proportionally runs relatively cheaply. We do things pretty efficiently here. I think it's the New Zealand way. We don't have two houses like you do in Australia, a Senate and a lower house. In Australia, you have the federal government and you have the state governments. We don't. We have just a single parliament, a single chamber. It's a pretty lean and mean machine here, and pretty efficient, I would have thought, too.
With MPs' travel and other expenditure, that's governed by the Remuneration Authority, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So your report doesn't really affect that. You can't recommend to them any changes.
No, we were just recommending changes to the funding of Parliament. And one of the things that I thought was quite important about, I think is very important about the New Zealand Parliament and its system, is that we are a very intimate democracy. In a lot of countries, you don't expect to see your senator or your representative, but in New Zealand, people do. And people expect to be able to go and see the local member of parliament at their office when they've got a problem, and they can. So we have to fund parliament and fund members of parliament to a state that they can be in a position to see their constituents in a reasonable way. So people shouldn't have to travel long distances, unduly long distances, to see the local member of parliament. They should have an office which befits the status of the local MP. It should be clean and comfortable, and it should be safe and secure because people are exposed. Members of Parliament have all sorts of people come and see them who are very upset and agitated. The staff have to be in a position which they are safe and secure, and we have to fund that. We have to make sure they have good communications between their office and Parliament, between the office and the Member of Parliament, so we need to fund that. People need to be accessible. And if we don't fund it properly, then the accessibility goes down. And if we have people, MPs, who are less accessible, then we have the public has less influence over the Member of Parliament and less influence on what Parliament and policy does. So one of the aims of this report was to ensure that we funded members of Parliament and their officers and their staff to assure ourselves that this access the public had to the members of Parliament was maintained or even enhanced. Another key point in our report, which I thought was quite novel, is we put a lot of emphasis on access to education and training. One of the things that I noticed when I came here a long time ago was no training for members of parliament. I had a hand in writing the first training program for new MPs and seen it grow and adapt. But the point is here in our thinking is that people don't go to university or don't go through their lives thinking, I'm going to be a member of parliament. People come from all sorts of walks of life and do not have a law or a parliamentary or a policy background. Now, this is a good thing. It means that parliament has this widespread base of knowledge and base of experience. But when people are here, they're here to be thinking about policy, be planning policy, making legislation, doing these things. They don't necessarily have the skill set for that. The second thing which happens is that people wind up in other areas than their natural expertise and require quite a lot of knowledge about running these. And there's several debates that have come up like this, such as genetic engineering. Who understood genetic engineering at the time? Climate change. What are the science in climate change? And the committee felt that more emphasis should be placed on education and training opportunities. What we found was that there were a very small three budgets, very limited amounts of money was available in them, and we've recommended to the Parliament that they need to draw this together, have a single oversight of it, and make it available so that members of Parliament can enhance their training. I see good value in members of Parliament going off to do courses at, say, Victoria University and the School of Government to learn about constitutional law, about those things. They're very helpful. It helps enhance people's ability to write. It helps in people's ability to enhances people's ability to do research for themselves. I also think that people should be able to go to courses and seminars on key topics and to sort of help broaden their knowledge. And what we want here is that we want members of Parliament to be the best that they can be, and we want to give them the hand like nearly other agency or any place. Accountants generally spend 2 to 5% of their income on a payroll on training. We spend nowhere near that amount. Every business knows that if you want to get the best out of your staff, you invest in staff training and development. This is one place where we do very little of it, and I think this is one place where we should do a lot of it. come back to my point, we want members of Parliament to be the best that they can be, and we should help them develop themselves and develop their knowledge and skill bases so they can be better parliamentarians, better writers of policy, better writers, scrutinisers of accounts, scrutinisers of legislation and so on. And the one element of this is the education element. I think this Parliament is underdone on that, could do a lot better, and I think it would be better for the country and better for the community. And the other point I make about it is whatever skill a Member of Parliament gets is never going to be lost to the community, because when Members of Parliament leave, they go on and do other things. And whatever roles they take up later, if they have a good knowledge and skill base, they take that with them, and the community will benefit from it.
What happens to the report now?
Well, it goes to the Parliamentary Service Commission. They'll debate it. The parties will decide whether they want to pick it up all in part. I suspect, like all of these things, they'll pick it up in part. One of the biggest challenges for them will be the suggested change to the way in which Parliament is funded. The governments of the day like to have control over things, and it's been this way for quite a long time, so it will be a big decision for it to shift away from there. I don't expect it to happen anytime soon, but I do think it's an important point that needs to be made. The Parliament itself should have control over its own expenditure, and it should be done in an open and transparent way, so that you cannot have the executive having too much influence over the running of Parliament by having control of the purse strings, which is what they currently have.
Right. So Parliament should control its own expenditure, but the decision over whether that happens or not remains with the government.
Of the day, at present, yes, it does.
And the government will have to give up power in order for that to happen.
Sure. But having made the observation and made the point, this is the first time it's been made for a long time. It was changed in the 1980s. I don't think people really quite appreciated what the implication of shifting the funding point was at the time. But having made the point now, I don't think the point's ever going to go away. I think it would be something that I would be surprised if subsequent reviews of Parliament didn't come back to it again. I'd be surprised if subsequent governments didn't come back to it again, because, as always in New Zealand, there's a go-around. And one of the great things about the New Zealand Parliament is that its standing orders and its rules are generally written on the basis that what goes around comes around. And so government parties, although they have control at certain points, realise that they're going to be in opposition and the rules are going to be applied to them. So the New Zealand standing orders are a great example of how they're written in both the interests of the government, and the opposition parties accept that the government of the day must be able to pass its legislation. But government parties also recognise that opposition parties need to be able to have a fair go and have plenty of opportunity to raise their points and their concerns. So they're nicely balanced. I think we just need to get to the same position on the funding of Parliament. And if this Parliament doesn't decide to make a change, I think it will be a subsequent Parliament which will do so and reshift the balance.